The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And a very good morning to you. This is the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio. It's a Friday. It's the 14th of April. And because it's a Friday, it means we have our Friday panel joining us on Zoom this morning. Three very articulate and august individuals who will be sharing their perspectives with us over the course of the next 55 minutes or so on the stories of the day. If you want to get in touch and take part in that conversation, you can call us on 074-91-25000. Niamh and Caroline taking your calls, Caroline producing this morning as well. You can also text or WhatsApp us on 086-60-25000. Don't forget, of course, we are on social media. It's Highland Hub on Facebook. We're at Highland Radio on Twitter. You can email us on comments at Highland Radio. And speaking of Facebook, by the way, don't forget, you can watch the show unfold live. And that's particularly pertinent on a Friday panel, of course, when we have our participants on Zoom. You can watch those conversations on Zoom online. You can also watch our entertainment slot later on. Of course, we're going to have Michael and Fionnuala in the studio with us as well for the entertainment slot. That's in the third hour of the programme. And they will have a legal advice with Seamus Gunn as well in the middle. So, as ever, it's a packed Friday. But we do want to get your views. We do want to get your perspectives on the story of the day as well. Right, without any further ado, let's go to our Zoom link and welcome our Friday panel. We are joined by Alan McMenamin, who is a community campaigner. Alan, a very good morning to you.
Morning, Donal. How are you?
Very well indeed, thank you. We're joined by John McAteer, a regular contributor, editor of the Tyrconnell Tribune newspaper, of course, and font of knowledge of all things Fannet and farther afield. John, good morning.
And to you as well, Donal.
And,
nice to be here.
And by Emma Dempsey, who's a teacher and also the director of the McGrath School of Speech and Drama. This, of course, has been a very important week for teachers, and we'll be getting into that. But for the moment, Emma, good morning.
Good morning, Donal. How are you? Good morning, gentlemen.
Hello.
Morning, Emma.
It's great to see you all, and you're all very welcome. Now, I suppose there's only one place we can start any discussion of current events this morning, and that's with the ongoing visit of Joe Biden. And I suppose there's two ways of looking at it. There is a man in his early 80s who is coming home to his ancestral home, meeting a lot of people, being very charming, saying the right things, getting to know everybody, and really making, it seems, a great impact. There's also the cynical view that we are spending millions on security, we are spending millions on getting this together, and is there going to be a payback? I'm going to ask you each in turn, starting with you, Emma. In terms of the Joe Biden visit, is this going to be a positive or a negative, or is it, yeah, whatever?
Oh, absolutely. It has to be seen as a positive, Donald. I mean, he has placed Ireland on that world stage for the past 3 days. And again, we're going to have that throughout international coverage again today. I mean, the entourage of US and international journalists that have followed his every move over the past couple of days, like Donny O'Sullivan was reporting live for CEN in the middle of Carlingford on Wednesday. I know we didn't have the best weather to showcase the east of Ireland, but we had that yesterday and hopefully we'll have that for the west. I mean, it's a huge, not just for, financial investment with all the US companies that we have that work here. I learned this during the week that there was maybe 210,000 people employed by over 950 American companies in Ireland. I mean, it's huge. We have to take this and celebrate it. We are so lucky we get it every year anyway on the 17th of March, but this is a bit of a Brucey bonus, isn't it, to have it for a full week-long event. And we really have to shore up all of that and work on it going forward. It just coincided nicely with the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement, but I definitely think we have a lot to gain from it here in the Republic, and we have to see it as that. Yes, it costs a huge amount, but, I mean, so did the Queen, so did Barack Obama, and we reeled in that for years afterwards also.
John McAteer, from your own point of view, you've been watching news for many, many years. You've seen US presidents come and go. You've seen US visits come and go. And I suppose, first of all, as someone who's seen a number of US presidents visit the country over the course of your career in journalism and your longer life with a deep interest in politics, how do you rate this one?
I think Joe Biden is the most folksy of the American visits. He's more Irish than the Irish ourselves. He just absolutely loves being here and he's getting very emotional about it. His speeches have been typical Joe Biden. He reaches out. He just reaches rather than preaches. His visit has been a very, very big success. Remember that he has been planning. He has been in Ireland before. This visit has been planned for about a year, but it's an endorsement of everything Irish and everything that the Irish has done for the Americans. It's a huge endorsement for the foreign direct investment. Emma talked about, 210 jobs. I think effectively when you run through all the foreign direct investment in Ireland and the spin-off business from it, it's about 400 jobs in total. It has made this country what we never could have even anticipated to be. And I'm glad that Joe Biden has been accorded the highest honours that an American president can give. I know you could talk about Northern Ireland till the cows come home, but the reality is that all of the Northern leaders, the five of them, were in the White House for St. Patrick's Day. It's just only over a month ago. And whatever he had to say to them then was said probably very clearly and very privately. And it's up to them now. He made it very clear in Belfast that he wasn't here to force them. He was just to encourage them. And he says, I just can't do it for you. You've got to do it yourself. I think the one telling remark that he made during his address in the Dáil yesterday was that he thought that the UK were not going far enough in their support of the endeavour, insofar as the peace process was concerned. That's as far as he would go, but he put that on record, and I think that is significant. But like his visit is a big, big, big success. And of all the eight presidents who have come here, he has been the most down-to-earth Irishman of them all.
And in terms, Alan McMenamin and John, I think he put his finger on it there, it's a folksy visit. Joe Biden, perhaps more than any other, and there's always been this when US presidents have come, we've always had this feeling he's here to pull votes, he's here to impress the Irish Americans back home, he's here with an agenda. You're getting the feeling Joe Biden isn't here with an agenda other than the fact that he wants to be here.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I kind of have a slightly different view to everybody else and probably in the minority in this. I mean, you know, yeah, he mightn't be here with an agenda, but there's always a rationale to anybody coming to any country, you know. And Joe is obviously, if he's seeking the support of the Irish Americans for any future campaign and so on. I'm a bit indifferent to his visit, you know, whilst I think it in the media, and it's been mad coverage across all media platforms, you know, about how positive it is and all the rest, you know, and yeah, it looks great, you know, from a neutral point of view. I think the benefit economically to the nation, I'm not too sure if there is any massive dividend there. I think that the jobs that were mentioned and all the rest are, they're here because they're getting massive profits and they're getting lower corporation tax rates than anywhere else in Europe. You know, the cost of the visit alone, the last time he was here in 2016 as vice president, cost about 5 to 6 million euro. This time it's going to cost probably in excess of 10, maybe 12 million euro. So, I mean, the visit politically, I suppose he was coming to shore up his support for the Good Friday Agreement on the anniversary of that. And that is particularly poignant from a political standpoint, I think. That can only enhance that there, and maybe in some regards kind of push those who are not participating in the Stormont Assembly to kind of maybe look at their views again. And it's also a message to England as well in terms of, yes, he has a different kind of relationship with Ireland, you know, but that Ireland is kind of important in the context of the European movement. But again, financially, I don't see any massive outturn for the likes of me, you, or anybody else on this call. I don't think it's going to impact me. I'm indifferent to the whole thing.
The argument is going to be that a lot of ministers and officials and IDA chiefs were over in the States last month for the St. Patrick's Day. And the reality is two things happen. The public thing happens where they go and they hand over a shamrock and they get photos taken in the White House. The behind-the-scenes things happen where they have meetings with industrialists, they have meetings with investors, they have meetings with fund managers, they have meetings with various people, college heads, academics, whoever. And then, you know, contacts are made, potential collaborations are discussed. Could it be that there are potential things in the offing, and maybe the visit of Joe Biden, the focus that brings on Ireland, the focus that brings on the relationship between Ireland and the UK, may be what pushes some of those potentials over the line?
Yeah, listen, there's definitely no doubt that there's obviously back channel and there's different things going on in terms of business and the economic side of it. But again, you know, I suppose the cynic in me says, well, that can happen anyway. You know, that's a natural thing. I mean, the other side of it is there's none of those American companies, multinational companies here in Ireland to benefit, truly benefit just the Irish state and give more tax back. I mean, and it's been quite proven, you know, in the revenue results, when you see the likes of Apple and Google and what they pay in terms of effective tax rate compared to what Irish companies pay. So, I mean, they're here to make money. They're not here to be best friends with Irish people.
Yeah. John, going back to you for a brief moment, Alan mentioned Northern Ireland there and the potential that maybe we may see some movement on the Stormont impasse as a result of the visit. Do you believe that's possible, John, that people like Geoffrey Donaldson and others will be in some way inspired by Biden's visit and may rethink their opposition to elements of the Windsor framework?
It's difficult to know. I would kind of half expect that it has to happen after the local elections in the North on the 18th of May. Biden's big message across the North to the politicians is that there's a carrot being dangled there of €6 billion of investment. That's a colossal amount of money, Alan, no matter how you look at it. Insofar as foreign direct investment in Ireland is concerned, our corporation tax rates, our take from it is increasing year on year. The first quarter is a way up again on last year. And it's that foreign direct investment that has made this country what we are now. You might say that there's a whole lot more to be done, and I'd be the very first to agree with that. But like, the American visit is something totally different. Joe Biden doesn't go to many countries. He doesn't need to come here, actually. I mean, his poll ratings across the various polls in the states for this point of his presidency is very, very good. Actually, it's better than any president for many, many years. But it'll be interesting to watch those polls next week, because I think they will increase dramatically given the heavyweight coverage that is getting here. It's a very pleasant village visit. And I think, you know, the signal's been sent out from Tuesday night when he arrived here, from meeting Rishi Sunak in Belfast, which apparently wasn't meant to be on the cards, from what I understand from the British media point of view, that Ireland Force is saying that he hates Ireland, completely untrue, he hates England. He doesn't hate England. He doesn't hate anywhere. But there's protocols about that there. In effect, if there was to be any kind of an official visit in Belfast on Tuesday night, or indeed on Wednesday, the Taoiseach would have been there, because we're co-guarantors of the Good Friday Agreement. And that's why that didn't happen, because his time in Northern Ireland was all too brief. But I think he left it very, very clear what they expect from the politicians. All five parties is get back into Stormont. They've been out for 40% of the time since they were founded. And I mean, the key element of the Good Friday Agreement was getting the Assembly up and running and trying to work it in harmony and in peace to drive the North forward economically, which it isn't happening. And it's a shame that it may not even happen after the 18th of May.
Yeah.
The reality here is that it may not happen if the DUP have got themselves into a corner that they can't get out of. And if they don't do well in those elections, then they'll have to rethink their whole strategy. Because now that they've walked away from it, how do they get back in without losing face? Joe Biden didn't say anything at all about that. It's not his place to do so, and he pointed that out again.
And he would have been potentially pouring petrol onto the fuel of the flames if he had
definitely.
Said... Yeah, Emma, I want to go back to you briefly, because in a sense, we've had the politics now. We've had the speech in the Dáil. We've had the meeting with Rishi Sunak. We've had the discussions with the various politicians. Today, he's on his way to Mayo. He's going to Knock. He's going to Ballina. In a very, very real sense, in Joe Biden's head, he's going home. And with the politics now almost out of the way, this is really going to be the day when the Irishness of Joe Biden comes to the fore, and this is going to be the day that the Irish community in the US and further afield is really going to lap up.
Oh, they're absolutely going to celebrate it. I was in Mayo during the week there, just came back yesterday afternoon, and the excitement there already. I could see them. The weather was absolutely atrocious, and they were putting out the railings and the stands and everything across Castlebar, Knock direction, and it's just palpable. They really are looking forward to it. And I think that's the fact, again, he's going to be celebrating his true Irish heritage on a world stage and on a platform for the rest of the world to enjoy. And hopefully the sun shines and we can enjoy that I suppose the knock-on effect of that when it comes to tourism, hospitality, the Wild Atlantic Way showcases it, absolutely. And that's what he's going to do for us. Yes, I totally agree with John. It is a folksy visit, but I mean, this is the most Irish of a president we've ever had. We may ever, ever see again. I mean, we're still talking about John F. Kennedy's speech in the Dáil how many decades ago. You know, Biden has given us so much more in the past 3 days and will continue to do so today. So, I'm a big Biden fan. Mm. Even as a vice president, I really admired him. I admire him for his integrity and his dignity has been as nearly his buzzword this week. So absolutely, I think it's going to be a great celebration for the West. And I only wish that he came further afield, but apparently there's claims to his heritage in Ballyshannon as well, with connections to the Scanlon. So, if he was coming this far, we certainly would be celebrating it also.
Yes, his great-great-great-granduncle, Andrew Scanlon, was born in a Coast Guard house. Now, I've heard Ballyshannon mentioned, mm-hmm. I've heard Killybegs mentioned. What we spoke to Kayleigh from the Genealogy Centre earlier in the week, now she said it could have been any one of 11 Coast Guard houses dotted around the Donegal coast, but he was born in a Coast Guard, and you can be sure every one of those 11 areas is going to be claiming it. But in the meantime, thank you all three. We're going to take a very short break. Back in a moment, and then we'll be back with you because we're going to discuss teaching and the teachers' unions conferences which have been taking place. We've seen all the teachers' unions hold their conferences this week, and we spoke to Donegal reps at all three of the conferences over the course of the past couple of days on the show. And Emma, it's fair to say that the two words we heard most, I think, from the teachers' reps, certainly from Donegal, were recruitment and retention. And it seems whether it's the vocational sector, the secondary sector, whether it's the national school sector, recruitment and retention do seem to be the two major issues.
Yes, absolutely. And it's evident in every school across the country, across the county, in my own school as well. I'm a primary school teacher. The people are just not there. The jobs are there. Now, having said that, that is one of the issues. We do need to look at more permanent contracts. We need to look at more full-time hours, especially for secondary school teachers, in order to give them that solid income that they know that they have for the year, and not just the part-time hours. In my own sector, in primary school, there are various days where subs cannot be found and teachers need to be redeployed because classrooms need to be taught, children in classrooms need to be taught, and then therefore you're compromising the teaching in other areas in the school because substitute teachers are not available, they just are not on the ground and can't be sourced. So it definitely, there needs to be initiatives implemented and implemented quickly in order to help resolve it. It's not going to be, I guess, they have increased the intake of trainee teachers to the undergrad programs. But I mean, that takes 4 years now. That's not going to be no quick fix. We definitely have a resource and a pool of teachers in different parts around the world that can be, I think, need to be attracted, need to be tried to encourage them to come back. But I mean, what are we encouraging them, or how are we going to encourage them to come back? And I think it really does come back to pay.
Yeah.
It comes back to a quality of pay as well. And that is something that's been a bugbear for a long time. And I am in that post-2011 grouping, unfortunately. And it's, you know, I don't think any teacher at the end of the day becomes a teacher for the money. Everybody does it for the love of the job. They want to do it. It's a rewarding, it has become a very changed job, a very more, even more challenging position, but it is a very rewarding and worthwhile job. However, I do feel that there's more and more pressures being put on our schools and more is expected of our schools. And I think it was only during COVID lockdown that the true value of what school meant in a community was really understood, and the value of teachers. And that was definitely acknowledged. However, it's been quickly forgotten. And with that, there's just constant negative PR towards teachers, to put teacher bashing as such. And it's, you know, it's rarely a positive story about teaching. And that definitely impacts all of those that work in the area. It's definitely hard in order to try to put any points across, because you're seen as whinging or complaining. But I mean, these are the men and women across Ireland that are dealing with your children, your grandchildren, for 30 hours a week, if not more, 182 days of the year. You know, these are the people that are providing safe, caring, nurturing environments for our children, the adults of tomorrow. And we offer stability and structure to the lives of children that don't have it perhaps at home. So I think that the PR has to be better, that the bashing has to stop, and the supports have to be put in right at the bottom, and therefore encouraging more people to take up this rewarding and truly enjoyable profession, and not making schools a stopgap for everything that can be possibly resolved. And therefore we need to look at the solutions to, I suppose, to recruit them, to bring them back, to encourage them to stay, and to offer them support throughout.
I left primary school in 1976, and I can name every primary school teacher that I had. And that probably does say something important. John, we spoke yesterday to Pádraig Curley from the ASTI. As I said, we spoke to all three of the unions, the representatives. We spoke to Anya and we spoke earlier as well. Now, and one of the things he said yesterday is, yeah, pay is a major issue, but it's more nuanced than that. And maybe sometimes we focus so much and the headlines focus so much on pay that we don't look at the wider issues that Emma has alluded to there. And maybe it's really time we did.
Well, absolutely. Teaching profession is probably one of the most difficult ones that we have, apart from nursing. You're very committed to it. You have parents to contend with, and I understand that the relationship between parents and teachers is quite excellent, and boards of management. None of those are the issues. The issues are financial to a great extent, and training, and why are they leaving? They're leaving for one reason: they can't afford and never will be able to afford to buy a house, to rent a house. And it's the same across Ireland. Almost every other conversation I have as a journalist in the last number of months, particularly since before Christmas time, is young people leaving. They're in decent jobs. You have to ask, what is a decent job in Ireland anymore? Do you need a salary of 60,000 a year to have enough money to build a house or even to rent? Is there a future for people? They're going to Australia, they're going to New Zealand, they're going to America. There's a brain drain of young people out of Ireland. Most of them are very, very well educated, very well qualified, and very well versed these days. There's something very far wrong. There's something seriously happening here. In our own parish, I think since Christmas time, there's at least 16 to 18 young people have gone. We can't afford to lose them because we would be one of those rural parishes with rural depopulation as one of our big headaches. Schools never seem to have their entitlements insofar as staffing levels are concerned. There are different. Everybody now that's born in Ireland is entitled to an education. Mm-hmm. And teachers are doing their best to provide that education against a background where they're not getting paid enough, really not getting paid enough, because it's the overall top figure, you know, your gross pay when you measure that about what you take home and the cost of living. It's not a good career option for so many people. But the government would have to look at that beyond the role of the teacher in the classroom. They would have to ask themselves, why have they to leave? They don't want to leave. They want to leave to make a better life for themselves. And the country's not affording them that because of our regime of taxation, let it be universal social charge, PRSI, or the general taxation system, probably more than half their wages gone. And then there's the cost of living, which is currently down a bit at 7.7%. That food inflation is a huge, huge issue here.
Yeah.
Anything that you want to do in the way of renting a house is costing a bomb. And as far as buying a house is concerned, most people can just throw their hat at that ideal. And unfortunately, that's where we should not be at in 2023.
Alan McMenamin, going to you, and I think it's a fair point to make that every one of us is here because we can read, because we have the capacity to analyse and to make decisions and to assess what we're hearing and to make decisions based on our analysis of what it is we're hearing, watching and seeing. And they're all skills that we started to pick up when we were in school, and they're all skills that were formed in school, and we have those skills because over the course of our lives we had good teachers.
Donal, I think it's one of these things that comes up annually, you know, around teachers, around nurses, around all our various professions that are, you know, really, really important to the nation. And I think what strikes me most is the fact that you have a Minister for Education who is a teacher, who is on a career break, who is a teacher, and she's not tuning into what the actual teachers' needs are. Pay is obviously vital in any job. Everybody, you know, likes a good wage, but it's what you mentioned earlier was the nuances. It's everything around that. It's the working conditions, security of tenure. You know, I mean, I have friends who are teachers who have taken career breaks to get out of here, to get away, to earn money, to earn some real money and have a life. You know, because as John alluded to, the cost of living here, it all impacts. But again, I think that the one thing is, and Emer mentioned it about the negative PR around teachers and, you know, teacher bashing, if you like. You know, that suits the government. That suits the state to just pit one sector against the other. you know, that, well, nurses are more deserving than teachers and so on and so on. And we need to get away from all that kind of narrative and look at the fundamentals. What are we sending our children to? You know, we want them to get the best education possible. We would like it to be free. It's not free. We're seeing children and teachers out protesting to try and get schools to be built, get out of porta cabins. And this is 2023, and we're still going on. This isn't improving in my eyes. It just seems to be an annual thing that keeps cropping up because, again, we don't have a policy that effectively addresses what the needs of teachers are, what the needs of students are, and a full policy review needs to be looked at. I'm looking at the numbers of teachers now who are on career breaks, you know, and you kind of have to ask yourself, well, why is there 3,153 teachers currently in the current year on a career break? You know, is it because they don't like the job, not enough money? I don't know. I don't know what the drill down and analysis of that is.
Certainly based on what John was saying, we can assume, I think, that in many, and you said it yourself, in many cases, people of your own personal acquaintance, it's anecdotal, but I suspect it probably reflects a reality, is you're saying they're leaving teaching because they want to go and, the phrase you used was, earn some real money. Now, there is an issue here. Teachers are paid from the public purse. John made the point earlier that one of the problems is that the level of tax is so high that what they are paid, they're taxed to the hilt on. If we're speaking about paying teachers more, investing more in schools, getting more public money into the education system, none of us are going to vote against that. But the reality is, in order to pay for it, you're either going to have to borrow or you're going to have to increase the very taxes that are part of the problem in the first place. Now, it maybe brings us back to the issue of corporation tax. And, you know, it maybe it brings us back, and do we need to have a complete overhaul of the taxation system to fund these public services? But a taxation system that's based on more than your income tax and also your various charges, your PRSAs and all those. I mean, is it time to look at the corporation tax and the intake from that and say, well, maybe we need to be getting a bigger take from there?
You know, I think, Donald, in fairness, like, I mean, this country's awash with money. The state coffers are awash with money. The problem we have is it's been spent in all the wrong areas. And, right, I go back to the previous conversation we had when we were looking at spending 5 million or up to 10 million for a state visit. Great and all as it may be, there may be offshoots from that. But again, we the country, the state revenue purse and the deficit and all the rest and the surplus is quite high. And we're spending the money in the wrong places. And we need to look at where are we getting the value for money out of. I mean, everybody has gone to school, whether they liked it or not. Some of us liked it, some of us didn't. You know, but again, you have to get a basic start in life. And the teaching and in schools, that gives you that. It gives you that security. During, as Emma said, during lockdown, like, teachers were working via Zoom, any means possible, you know. And it is quickly forgotten. And the state quickly forgets it. And I think that, you know, the whole corporation tax thing, it needs to be paid for, yes, but there's enough money there to pay for it. And why aren't we paying it?
Emma, you wanted to come back in there?
Yeah, definitely. It needs to be invested in, from the ground up, from the age of 5 when the child goes to school. And I have to admire that the 2-year preschool program now has been a great benefit, and those that have enjoy it and take it up come to school more school ready. But we need to try to reduce our class sizes. I mean, we're still one of the highest in Europe. And every year they say we've dropped, the ratio has dropped by one pupil. We never see it on the ground. I don't see it. My colleagues don't see it. Teaching principals shouldn't be a thing anymore. It's not possible to do 2 jobs and to do them effectively, and something has to give. And there's pressures and strains like that. And complete burnout is also causing people to take these career breaks, not just the opportunity to go to Abu Dhabi to make extra money to be able to find a deposit for a house. But I mean, all of these things need to be looked at. We need to, you know, we are post-COVID, but we are still dealing with the ramifications in school of that 2-year breakdown in our life, because this is going to be a generational impact on the children that are continuing through their education. Students in first, second, third class that missed those early years of the fundamentals of school, you can see that coming through to the fore now, and you are trying to mop that up and fill in those gaps, and it's just not possible. And you're also dealing with a huge influx of maybe non-nationals coming into our schools as well, and while we welcome them wholly and support has been offered in capacity as EEL, perhaps English as an additional language and additional supports and teaching with that, the conditions are totally different to what we were working with perhaps 10 years ago, and the backup isn't there, and we need that. We need more teachers here at home. We need smaller class sizes, and we need better funded resources and facilities in order for us to do that. And there are a few options. I think maybe if they lowered the cost of training, perhaps. I know I looked at it originally doing a PGCE in England 10 odd years ago, 15 actually, and I was offered incentives to go. At that stage, it was about £6,000. But currently, there's funding in England to do your postgrad certificate in education of between £7,000 and £24,000, depending, particularly if it's a secondary school subject that they are short of. They will give you that bursary to go and do your training. So therefore, that's covering your education, your fees, your accommodation. It's with the fact that all educational training now has gone to a master's level, it's increased the length of the duration of your training. So therefore increased your fees and your outgoings and your accommodation and everything else. And then you have to go and try and find a job at the end of it. And while we're crying out for teachers, it's not always easy then to get a job. So it does not make sense.
Well, we have Simon Harris as Minister for Higher Education. We have Norma Foley in the Education Brief. Do they both need to sit down and have a good long meeting and discuss those issues?
I think they need to sit down and talk to people on the ground and listen to what's happening and what has been dealt with Monday through Friday, and more collaboration, more with those that are on the ground and from the department. I mean, the nature of it is you could get a department circular issued at 5 o'clock on the Friday of a bank holiday weekend of massive ramifications for your school. How is that conducive to positive working relationships or suitable and efficient working relationships? It just doesn't make sense. They're removed from the reality of what's being dealt with Monday to Friday, 9 to 3.
And I'm glad there, the teacher.
That Emma, that you mentioned there as well, like the, you know, class sizes, you know, I'm a young 50-year-old and all my life I've been hearing about class sizes and nothing's really been done on class sizes. And, you know, so I mean, this is what I'm saying about this annual conversation is always happening and it's never really been effectively addressed until the, you know, and unfortunately, I mean, we've had a Taoiseach who was a teacher. We've had a Minister of Education or teachers and you're thinking, well, did they leave their rational hat at the door whenever they entered the Dáil, you know, because you're kind of going, why is this continuing? And it's cropping up every year and it will not change until, well, I won't say a change of government will actually change it. It might, who knows? But again, I think they need to get real about things. And unfortunately, they're focused on other things that aren't positively impacting anybody.
You're listening to our Friday panel here on the 9 till noon show. That's the voice of Alan McMenamin, a community campaigner. We also have John McAteer, who is the editor, of course, of the Tyrconnell Tribune. And you've been listening to Emma McGrath, who's a teacher and founder of the McGrath School of Speech and Drama. Just a few of your comments that have been coming in. Emma for President is the first time I've ever heard the true reality of my teaching job. That's from one of our callers. Hi, Donald Caller says, teachers are the most important profession in the world. They're a hugely important profession. As I said, the reason the four of us are able to have this conversation is because we learned skills of reading and rationalisation and assessment and discernment, and we learned those from teachers in primary school in particular. Teachers are way and above the teachers of the past. I've dyslexia. It wasn't noticed until I left school. I'm talking 20 years ago. I'm an SNA now. Teachers of the past wouldn't come close to the teacher now. The quality. Now, I think I'm always iffy about comparisons like that because I think societally there's a lot more awareness of things like, dyslexia and other issues. I think that's not just, I'm very loath to compare one profession with another because I think, yeah, there's a societal appreciation of issues that wasn't there in the past. If a Joe Biden visit brings so much potential from investment, etc., then why doesn't he go to poor African countries where investment is badly needed and do some real good? So helping the Good Friday Agreement and democracy in Ireland to run more smoothly won't benefit Ireland, North and South, financially and socially. What planet are your panellists on? I think one of our panellists, Alan in particular, was perhaps questioning how much Joe Biden's visit would achieve those aims and would those aims be achieved without him. What is that man talking about? Sleepy Joe is not Irish. Seemingly the whole world is Irish. at the minute. The man hasn't a clue what he's doing, saying there's a big difference between... Look, the black and tans thing. Look, the man made a mistake. We all make 7 mistakes a day. Joe Biden has a slip of the tongue. He says black and tans instead of all blacks, and suddenly he... Ah, lads, come on, come on. Look, I mean, no. There's more important things than someone making a mistake. Believe you me, if I was pulled up with every mistake I have made this week in conversation, I probably wouldn't have a job. Let's be honest about it. Biden's visit has done more harm to an already damaged relationship with the hardline unionists. What major role did he play in the Good Friday Agreement back in the 90s? Alan is right. Your two other panellists are wrong if they think Biden is going to change anything here in Ireland. He's here to secure his Irish vote in the States. There is more Irish in a bag of spuds than there is in Joe Biden. I wouldn't accept that. I think there is a genuineness in what Biden is doing. Now, I'm sure there is a political imperative to it too, let's be honest. Ask that woman what she's on about no teachers. My daughter and a friend have been out a teacher for the past 3 years and no jobs, only summing. So what are they... Yeah, and I think in fairness, that's one of the things that the unions have been saying is, look, create permanent posts and don't have people subbing all the time. Another caller, I asked the faithful to join in prayer today for a change of heart in Joe Biden regarding his support for the present day Holocaust of abortion. He knows the teachings of the Catholic Church. So says one of our callers. Now, we're going to take a short break. Back after these with more from our panel.
Watch the show live now on YouTube, Facebook and at highlandradio.com.
This is the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio. Just taking a brief look. No, we won't take a look at the weather forecast today. We will do that in a moment. Before we do anything else, though, I just want to give you some more comments. Then we're going to take another very quick break. We're going to do the weather and then get back to our panel. If Biden loves the Irish the way he says he does, then why doesn't he help all the hardworking, undocumented Irish who are in America? They can't come home on holiday or for funerals for fear of not being able to get back in. What are you talking about? America is doing well, says the caller. The price of gas is sky high. America is at a proxy war with Russia and we all know it. He comes to Ireland proclaiming to be Irish. He's more English, but that's never discussed. His approval rate in America is the worst ever for a sitting president. His agenda of being a Catholic, yet he supports abortion, is disgraceful. Another caller says, not sure where your speaker is getting his information, but corporation tax in Ireland is flat at 12.5%. There are no increases. Now, in fairness, our panellist didn't say that corporation tax was rising. He said corporation tax intake is rising. So the amount of money coming from corporation tax is rising. Now, the rates, as I understand it, are to rise. The companies that make in excess of, I can't remember the figure off the top of my head, I think it might be 5 billion, but I can't remember the figure off the top of my head. But higher earning companies will have their corporation tax increased to 15% in the future. It's the Friday panel here on Highland Radio's 9 till noon show. We're joined by Alan McMenamin, who is a community campaigner. We're joined by John McAteer, the editor of the Tyrconnell Tribune, and by Emma McGrath, who is a teacher and the co-founder of the McGrath School of Speech and Drama. One of the stories we covered on the show this week is the designation of potential zones in the waters off our coast for wind farm developments. And there is an area of the coast off Donegal designated for potential wind farm developments into the future that's pretty much as large in size as the county itself. And that's been picking up some debate this week. John McAteer is a man who knows the coast and a man who knows the inshore fishers, particularly in Fannet, but further afield as well. What's your take on this one?
I'm glad to see the KFO, the Killybegs Fishermen's Organisation, taking a lead on this and trying to lead rather than react to the whole project. I listened to the discussion on yesterday, and there's going to be huge reaction to it. There's going to be huge opposition to it, as you'd expect. But at the end of the day, these offshore sites are going to be developed. The turbines are going to be put in there. This is a very, very big plan, costing $3 billion. It's going to provide about one-third of Ireland's wind energy. And with Sean O'Donoghue and his team in there having set down 6 principles that the hope that Hexagon will buy into and help develop it. It's going to go ahead anyway, whether we like that or not. We've been yearning for a move away from the current system to more wind-based energy. It's now about a third or probably slightly higher. And that is an achievement in itself, given the cost of it. I would welcome any debate and discussion on that, and it needs to be very fairly widespread, and it's just only starting there because they're going to apply for planning permission for it. It's going to be 50 kilometres off the South Donegal coastline. And whether we buy into it or whether we don't, it's going to go there anyway because companies are going to come in and do it.
Alan, from your point of view as a community campaigner, you're well used to discussions on various potentially controversial developments and controversial issues. What's your take on this particular one?
I suppose looking at the whole offshore one farm thing in Ireland, it's nothing new, really. I mean, there's actually 69 offshore wind projects currently in operation in Ireland. Some are further advanced than others. There's only one connected to the actual grid. The majority of them are failing mid-planning, not because of objections or anything else, but because of they don't have the sustainability aspect to it. The difficulty I have with any kind of wind farm, whether it be onshore or offshore, is, again, I don't think we're deriving the benefit to the end user, i.e. the consumer. We've seen if we have 30% electricity going back into the national grid from wind farms, we're not getting the benefit of that in your bi-monthly bill. You know, we've seen energy prices rocketed through the last year and a half. Yet and all, if we have a third of our electricity coming from wind, why is it more and more expensive all the time? So I'm very kind of, I'm concerned, I have to say, about the one for Donegal, primarily because I don't think it's fully thought out. And that's no disrespect to the company that's actually going to be doing it. I do think the state should be taking a more proactive approach in this, because again, we've had Shell to Sea, we've had all these kind of prospecting licenses for oil and gas and so on around the country. Pretty much our natural resources being given away to organizations to invest, yes, billions, but to derive multiple billions in return. So I think that there needs to be a proper risk management strategy set out for an offshore wind farm.
From the economic point of view, the argument is that, as you say, prices are rising. Now, we're told over the course of the past year, the prices are rising because natural gas supplies, which would traditionally have come from Russia, they now have to be sourced elsewhere. The war in Ukraine is having a huge effect. So there is a major rise in the price of gas right across Europe. And the more you can generate from wind economically, and we'll just park the environmental thing to one side for a moment, but the more you can generate from wind, the less your reliance on gas, and the less your reliance on gas and the more you can use wind power generated on your own shore, then the less you're going to depend on Russia, the less you're going to depend on suppliers in the UK and Holland, etc., and the more secure you're going to be. Is that naivety personified?
Well, I suppose that when you look at it from the point of view that we are not very gas reliant in the state. You know, we're the one country in Europe who has got minimal gas supply. We don't have interconnectors with Northern Ireland or England and so on around gas. So, I mean, we, you know, this narrative about, oh, well, the cost of energy has rocketed because of the war in Ukraine. Well, it was going up anyway prior to that. You know, during lockdown, you've seen the home heating oil was so inexpensive, and now it's quadrupled and it's fluctuating up and down and all the rest. And I just see that I think the companies are, I shouldn't say price gouging, that's probably unfair of me. I don't have vast amount of evidence in that, but the gas thing doesn't stand up at all. There was a gas pipeline meant to have been coming from Northern Ireland into Donegal back in 2007. The plans were outlined to do that. It never transpired because it was too expensive. So, I mean, if we really want to promote the green energy, whether it be wind, onshore or offshore, we need to do it properly and we need to derive more of a benefit to the end user. What I will say as well is when I mentioned about the risk, you know, there is a lifespan to all these projects that are going at the minute. There's quite a number of offshore projects around the world that have reached 20 years and they're becoming defunct. They're not being upgraded. They're just being closed. Now, 50 kilometres off the south Donegal coast, if you had one of the biggest offshore wind farms out there and 20 years later it becomes defunct, I don't think that's a good project. You know, and I can't see it how it becomes sustainable. Yeah.
Emma, going to yourself, one of the really important things here is going to be consultation. Consultation with fishers, consultation with the general public. We're told it'll be probably minimum 7 to 10 years before anything actually happens off the Donegal coast. Important that we use that time for consultation and for real discussion, not just box-ticking exercises.
Yeah, absolutely. Those people, I suppose, living on the coast that are going to be affected by it most, and the members of the KFO, want to feel that they're listened to and that their points are being valued and taken on board, as you say, rather than just ticking that box and saying, yeah, we've had these consultations and therefore, yeah, we've done that, but we're still going to proceed as we wish anyway. I guess I agree with John. It is going to be inevitable. We need to look at more sustainable, more economic, or more, better environmentally friendly ways to source our energy. You do have to wonder, it is, I suppose, a bit of a contradiction, the fact that we're trying to create these more environmentally friendly ways of producing electricity, but therefore are we compromising the state of our natural environment at the same time? But I guess with everything in life, there are compromises. Go back to the Good Friday Agreement at the top of the show. There's compromises, and we just have to perhaps deal with that if we can feel that we're getting the greater good or the benefit from it. But I do agree with Alan also that I think consumers need to feel it in their pocket also, and not to think that this is what we're being sold, and inevitably it doesn't impact us in a positive way at the end of the day.
Emma McGrath, teacher and co-founder of the McGrath School of Speech and Drama. Thank you very much indeed for speaking to us. John, I want to go back to yourself very briefly and just raise another issue. You wrote extensively about it in the Tyrconnell Tribune this week. You've been posting on it in social media, and indeed we spoke to Councillor Padraig McGarvey about this on Tuesday after a meeting of the Letterkenny Milford Municipal District. The need for a flood relief scheme in Remelton. We saw bad flooding there last month, and the fear now is if we have to wait the years it'll take to get a Remelton flood relief scheme up and running, we could be in trouble.
I think we are in trouble already in Remelton, because it's the quay side there, the shore road, is very low lying. There's a seawall there that's probably a couple of hundred years old. And I was just walking past there yesterday when I was out walking the dog. I can't believe that the wall has gone into a serious state of deterioration. Stones, big stones coming out of it all over the place. It's obviously a stone and lime construction. And during that flooding there in March, it was quite evident that water was coming in through that wall, and it was damaged there the other week again. It's an accident waiting to happen. I don't think Remelton can afford to wait for 3 years for flood relief. I think it's needed now. And we go back to what Alan's been saying there about the state intervention. We're light years behind here. The government seems not able to come to terms with the need for increased infrastructure that you were referring to about the schools, Emma. 30 years ago, we had just over 3 million people in this country. We now have over 5 billion. We're not coping with that very, very well. And the machinery of government works all too slowly. And we're seeing that all over Donegal. We've seen it around Letterkenny. Getting into Letterkenny this week, the other day I was sitting at the Ulster Junction, not very far from where you're sitting, Donal. Mm-hmm. I had an appointment, a clinical appointment, at 3 o'clock. Sitting there at 2:30, I should have been at the clinical appointment in 6 minutes flat, easily. 45 minutes later, I got to the clinical appointment. Everything was thrown into disarray because people were arriving late. Something shocking wrong about the whole infrastructure, but we're talking here about Remelton. We have a new young councillor there, and it's going to take him all his energy and all his time. And you have Liam Blaney and you have John O'Donnell there as well. But there is money. There's money in the pipeline. It's getting it through all the processes of design and getting it out to contract and actually getting the firm on the ground to go and do it. I can't understand that it's 3 years since this. It might be 4 years since Joe McHugh mooted that. And it's sitting there in stage one, phase one. Yeah. In effect, it's going nowhere very fast.
And in the meantime, people along the quay, people on the shore road are thinking, what happens if we get a really heavy rainfall and that wall goes? Because it's a very real prospect.
And, you know, absolutely, the shore road in Remelton in this last number of years has become very, very busy commercially. There are apartments there, any number of them. There are important businesses there. And they need better than what they're getting from Donegal County Council and from the state. And if they can't get their finger out and get that project up and running, most of those businesses will disappear in 5 years.
Well, people could well remember Greg spoke to one of the apartment dwellers in Remelton last month during those floods, and she literally was upstairs and couldn't get down the stairs and out of the apartment because of the level of flood water that was at the bottom. John Mackett's here, editor of the Tyrconnell Tribune. Thank you very much indeed for speaking to us this morning. Also, Emma McGrath, the teacher and co-founder of the McGrath School of Speech and drama. Thank you very much, Emma, for your contribution today. And finally, to community activist Alan McMenamin, as ever, a great contribution from you as well. All four of you, it's been a great Friday panel. I always say whenever I do this show, it's the fastest hour of the week by far. And that's down to the quality of the discussion. And this was a good one. Emma, John, Alan, thank you all very much indeed.